Here we go. A funny thing happened on the way to the broadcast this afternoon. We got an entrepreneur, a mountain climber, and an education data guy. Took them to a bar and started asking them questions. Mobility is our theme today in all of its economic variation. From American Public Media and a live audience here at the Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado. I think you're out there, right? Come on. Let's go. There we go. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MailChimp. More than 8 million businesses around the world use MailChimp for email newsletters, A/B testing, and marketing automation. More at MailChimp.com. And is supported by the University of Southern California.
It's Monday, the 29th of June. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody. As I said, we are at the Belly Up, the premier music club here in Aspen, with, I don't know, 250, maybe 300 people in the audience at the Aspen Ideas Festival for what is going to be, honestly, not your usual kind of marketplace. Because sometimes the straight-ahead look at the economy gets tiresome. I know. I said it. So in a couple of minutes, some conversations on one of the biggest issues in the American economy right now. You're going to be hearing a lot about it in the 498 days we have left until Election Day. Mobility is what we are after. How we move around in this economy, both literally and philosophically. First, though, the news of the day, which is also, in a way, about mobility as well, because there are few things in the world less mobile right now than Greeks and their money. David Leonhardt runs the Upshot at the New York Times, their website devoted to economics and politics and all things that interest you and your gang, right?
That's correct.
All right, David, it is always great to have you back on the program.
It's good to be back.
Let's set up Greece real quick, right? Yes, a round of applause for David Leonhardt. Not to mention his kids out there, who I didn't see applauding, but that's a whole different deal. Let's set up Greece really quickly, right? Negotiations have broken down. There's going to be a referendum on Sunday. There are capital controls in place. The banks are closed. The markets are closed. That is not a good omen, yeah?
No, it's scary. It's really scary. And so one of the things we're seeing once again is that austerity is absolutely a terrible way to deal with a financial crisis. It feels good. We want to do austerity. We want to say you've behaved badly. And Greece has definitely behaved badly over the years. And so we're going to sock it to you. But it failed in the United States with Hoover. It failed in Japan. We've seen it fail in Europe. And so the question is, how do we help Greece to get on its feet right now, rather than how do we worry about these long-term issues?
All right. So I'm going to ask you exactly those questions in a minute. First, though, some tape from Athens this morning. Our correspondent, Stephen Beard, went to Athens a week ago, did three or four stories on people trying to get by there, right? One of the people he talked to was Nick Volas. He's an American-born entrepreneur. He's run a gourmet sandwich shop in Athens since the 90s. Here's what he said this morning about the current state of affairs.
So I had taken all my measures. I already had all the raw materials I need to do my work for at least a few three, four months, and my money was not in the bank.
Small businessman. That laugh, by the way, I stepped on it, but that's the sad laugh, right? His money's not in the bank. He's laid in supplies for 3 or 4 months. Where's the growth going to come from in Greece if small business people are scared like he is?
So that's what we have to do is get past this initial crisis. And the idea that he wants to go get his money out of the bank and it's not there, that's exactly what happened in these crises, right? That's what It's a Wonderful Life is with Jimmy Stewart. And that's why they put in capital controls. That's why they closed the banks. Basically, what they want to do is they want to prevent this from unraveling right now. And then longer term, you can worry about things like what does his business need to do? What does their education system need to do? Right now, what we need to worry about is how do we make sure that Greece doesn't lead to A, a further crisis in Greece, and B, potentially a financial crisis that could end up affecting Europe, could end up affecting the United States, end up affecting the global economy.
The phrase that a lot of the experts, I guess, in this are using is ring fence. They want it, right? They want to ring fence the Greek economy, seal it off from the rest of Europe, right? And protect the rest of Europe while making sure that Greece survives. Do you believe that is viable?
Well, so there are two ways to answer that question. The first is, if you're in Greece, you're inside the ring fence, right? And so you can't have the crisis ring-fenced off if you're inside Greece, right? And so if we're talking about the situation for people in Greece, there's no way in which that is—there's no way that's encouraging. For the rest of the global marketplace, I think the answer is probably. I think probably we are going to be able to prevent this from becoming a crisis. But when you're talking about a global financial crisis, probably really isn't the answer
you want.
No, that's
not what I want
to
hear,
it's like not making you feel a lot better if I'm telling you this probably won't lead to a global financial crisis.
So one more piece of tape from a woman in Athens. She works in a bank, which means she's off work today, right, because the banks are closed. Her name is Efi Panoutsakopoulou, I think.
Well done.
And here's what she said this morning when we called her and said basically, how's it going?
Everybody's numb. They don't know how to react. They don't know what to do.
Where's the growth going to come from? If small business people, right, like Nick and now Efi, are just scared, what happens?
If you want to end with one reason for optimism, it's that the Greek economy does have real strengths. It is a first world economy in many ways. It's a fairly educated economy. It is part of this wonderful market that is Europe, where you can sell a lot of things.
For now,
if you can imagine Greece getting past this crisis, there are reasons to be optimistic in the long term. There are reasons to have an answer to the question, where does the growth come from? But right now, those are tomorrow's questions. Today's questions are, how do we avoid this crisis from becoming worse?
We're going to ask those tomorrow. David Leonhardt from the New York Times. David, thank you so much. Thanks, man. Perfect. Awesome. Good. Wall Street Today, I feel very, very confident in saying it's going to be the wah-wah trombones. We will, as we always do, have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so mobility thematically now, through data and the internet and how that relates to people getting where they want to go in this economy. Jose Ferreira is the founder and CEO of Newton. It's an adaptive learning company. It uses data to personalize education student by student. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Robin Chase, closest to me, is probably best known for co-founding Zipcar, the car sharing company. She is now the CEO of a company called Venium, working on the Internet of Moving Things, which is, first of all, thank you both for coming. Internet of Moving Things. Define the term for me, would you, Robin?
The Internet of Moving Things is connecting up all that sensor data that we have throughout cities and putting it into the internet so that we can do some big data analysis and figure out what in heck is interesting.
Do you put like hotspots on cars and drive them around? Is that the way?
So we put hotspots on cars and drive them around.
All right. Very good. I think. I don't know. Jose Ferreira, let me ask you what adaptive learning means.
Well, it's the idea that instead of everybody having the exact same textbook or the exact same experience in school, they should have an experience that uses the total data that they're producing but losing to the cloud all the time to produce a concept-by-concept experience for them that can figure out exactly what they know and exactly how they learn best, to predict failure in advance, deliver you math in the morning if that's when you learn math best, deliver you science in 14-minute bite sizes if that's how you learn that best.
Right. Okay, so let me try to come up with the grand unifying theory of having you two together, which in my mind as we set this up was technology and mobility, right? You are obviously interested, Jose, in human capital and mobility, and you, Robin Chase, are interested in facilitating, I would imagine, that thing we now call the Internet of Things, yes?
Yeah, when I listened to what Jose said, what struck me is that both of us are leveraging things that existed and weren't analyzed before, that they didn't get into big data. So I look at it as excess capacity and how can we make use of things and multi-purpose things that didn't used to be used that way before. So we're using vehicles that are moving throughout cities anyway, and as they're moving throughout cities, we can use multiple types of spectrum and collect this data and get it to where it needs to go.
And then do what with it, right? How does that take us and get us to a better, different place? Or a better, worse place? I don't know.
I think there's a lot of different ways. Right now, if we think of vehicles, they are the one thing that is not connected that we use all the time, that's not really connected to... We don't have that data. When we think of smart cities, it's all about what is that data, smart homes. Again, all of that stuff that we imagine this promise today, that data is just kind of lying dead there because it hasn't been able to get into the place to be analyzed. So it's connecting up things and people. And the reason we're able to do this, both of us, is that we're building these platforms that I think of as platforms for participation that are now making it very simple for people to do these very, we take complex things and make them simple.
Right.
So we're getting all that data and making it simple.
Jose, you're nodding. So explain that a little bit, right? Because you can't be the first guy who ever thought to use data in education. Or maybe you could.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I started doing stuff like this for Kaplan, the big American education company, in the 90s, and they were one of the first companies really taking a hard look at applying data, computer adaptive data to education. So, and I built those programs for them, so I was one of the first. But much as Robin was saying, I mean, every time a student sits down to study, she produces, you know, millions of data points. We have some students who produce up to 10 million data per day per student.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's like a typical Google search.
What are they studying?
Well, it's what they're learning and how, and to the percentile to which they're learning it, how they're learning it best, how well the content's working. It's an incredible amount of data. And up until now, it's just always been lost.
Right. So that's actually a good follow-up question. How finally do you parse this data that will then be used to improve, in theory, the mobility of human capital through this economy? Is it answer D on a test versus answer E on a test?
No. We measure things down to the atomic concept level, down to the percentile level per student. So we can tell you what your percentile proficiency is on every single concept you're studying, and it's accurate to within 1 or 2 points versus the rest of the population. We can also tell schools, hey, there's a woman in a Cambodian fishing village that's a genius, and we're reaching her, and we can tell that, you know, she is just learning stuff at a deeper level of proficiency, learning it faster, retaining it longer. She's a prodigy. Harvard, you should let her in. She's going to cure breast cancer one day.
Robin Chase, it seems to me that part of what you are trying to do is hardware dependent, not just the technology of it, but you got to have the cars, you got to have the servers, you got to have the Wi-Fi, you got to have that whole smash.
Venium is a company that's really the software aspects, but it's also building hardware today. But we're leveraging, you know, existing buses. So in Porto, Portugal, every bus is enabled. Everyone's using free Wi-Fi on those buses, and we're taking the trash receptacles. Are they fully? Are they empty? Where is the closest taxi? And if we think about things like Zipcar, which I co-founded, or Lyft and Uber, all of those things are taking assets and now sharing them and multipurposing them in ways that didn't used to be able to happen before. So it's really technology that is this brand new enabler of many, many small parts.
And it is the collaborative economy, right?
It's the collaborative economy.
Right.
So I just wrote this book called Peers, Inc., which is really trying to take it from, it's not just Zipcar, it's not just Venium, it's not just José's company, Newton, and you're speaking later with Netflix. All of those things are, in fact, connected. This idea of the open data movement, the massive online courses, or very detailed online education.
Right.
But all of it is the ability now to build platforms that make it very simple to deal with lots of small parts and repurpose and multipurpose things in brand new ways. It's very efficient.
José Ferreira is the name of the game now with data and interactivity and the collaborative economy. Is it get on board or you're going to get left behind?
Yeah.
Okay, so Robin's nodding. And that was,
yes, no, for sure. Data. There's enormous value in data at scale. The problem up until the internet and mobile devices came along was that it cost too much to aggregate the data and to order the data. Data require good ordering in order to be usable,
right?
And interoperable. But now, IT makes that stuff. The cost of capturing data and ordering it nearly free.
And the IT guys are completely important. They've been saying it for years, but now it's true. José Ferreira from Newton and Robin Chase from Zipcar, also the company Venium. Her book is called Peers Incorporated. Thank you all very much for coming. Coming up, mountaineering and also the mobility of Netflix. But first, let's do the numbers. No, how is it not the Wawa trombones not today? Are you kidding me? I don't understand how that happened. The Dow Industrials lost 350 points today, 1.9%, 17,596. The NASDAQ off 122 points, 2.4%, 49.58 there. The S&P 500 gave back 43 points, 2%, ended things at 2,057. Big Wall Street banks, as you might imagine, were the losers on the day. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley off about 3% apiece. JP Morgan Chase fell more than 2%. By way of corporate news, there was some. General Electric continues to unplug itself from the financial sector. GE is selling its businesses that manage vehicle fleets in the U.S., Mexico, Australia, and New Zealand. The buyer is Element Financial of Canada. GE shares down 1.6% today on the news. Bonds, you'd have thought there'd have been flight to safety there. There was some bonds up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board issues its June Consumer Confidence Index. Across the pond, Wimbledon enters its second day and continues through July 12th. And educational events are planned at museums and in communities around the globe for Asteroid Day to raise awareness about detecting asteroids and the potential threat they pose. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are live today from the Belly Up in Aspen, Colorado at the Aspen Ideas Festival. And sometimes, as Robin Chase and Jose Ferrer were saying a couple of minutes ago, one idea can transform all industry. It can change how we interact with each other. It can change our long-established habits as well. Ted Sarandos is the Chief Content Officer at Netflix, the company that has, getting back to the theme of the day, redefined the mobility of content. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
First of all, what's going on?
Yes.
There you go.
Give him a second to applaud.
But, it's a very recalcitrant crowd with its applause.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not actually sure what that says. Probably something about me, but that's a whole different deal. First of all, what's going on with season 3 of House of Cards, man? I'm only like 3 in. And
we
I,
are in
I
production.
Are you for season 4 now?
For season 4.
Wow. Yeah.
I can't tell you anything about 3. You got to watch it all.
Can you tell us when it's going to drop?
They've been running about almost exactly a year apart.
All right,
so
okay.
Probably
right.
February, March of next
right,
year.
Fair enough. I want you to tell me, speaking of House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and all this other stuff you guys are doing, tell me about the meeting where one of you, you're all sitting around some conference table, and one of you says, you know what? Original content. That's the way for us to go. Tell me about that meeting.
It was a hot one. It was a meeting. Basically, the actual House of Cards was the show that came of it. But the idea of going to original programming was if we believed our own we were drinking our own Kool-Aid and believed that this was going to be the wave of the future in terms of the way people consume content,
right,
then we were going to have to be differentiated not just by having superior technology and a great user interface, but by the programming that we offer. And so the only way we were going to have exclusive programming that we could launch in different models, like all the episodes at once, would be to produce it ourselves.
How long did it take from first idea to House Cards being on the air? Was House Cards the first one? House Cards was the first one, right?
The actual first on air was a show called Lilyhammer.
Okay.
The first deal we did was for House of Cards. And then in the meantime there, we came across Stevie Van Zandt with a cool show that they were producing in Norway called Lilyhammer. Yeah. And we got to watch a couple of the episodes and premiered around the world everywhere outside of Norway.
Cool. Do you care where we get our content from, whether it's or how we get our content, whether it's a TV in front of my couch or my phone or my tablet? Do you care?
Not at all. Not at all. We just want you to have the best experience possible. And for some times, that best experience is defined by convenience.
Yeah.
It just happens to be where you are. And other times, it's by fidelity. I want to see it in that giant screen streaming in 4K.
Right.
And it just depends on where you are and what you define as excellence.
So we can just pick it up and go.
Yes, and that's what, you know, the beauty of the service is you watch it on your phone for a few minutes while you find something.
Right.
You're hooked for 5 minutes. Just hit stop, go home, hit play again. It picks up right where you left it off across like 700 different devices around the world.
This has been touted as a great age and era for content in television. You guys, though, have done a deal, I guess, with Brad Pitt and feature films.
Yes.
Does that lend itself to the same mobility of concept theory?
Absolutely. Maybe even more so, because movies tend to travel even better than television around the world. So all the kind of behavior, people do want to slip away and escape into a movie and watch it in a dark room. But a lot of people, believe it or not, are watching Lawrence of Arabia on an iPhone. So it's hard to say where you want to watch it, but we just want to deliver it to you.
Show of hands. Lawrence of Arabia on an iPhone? Anybody?
No.
Yeah, no. All right.
By the way, I agree with you.
No, there wasn't not a single person. Not a single person.
You have to remember where we are. Okay?
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, speaking of where we are and this idea of mobility of content, you guys are now spreading out internationally as well.
Yes.
I mean, this is a thing that you believe the world has a hunger for.
Yeah, absolutely. You can watch Netflix now in over 50 countries. And the content itself, all of our original programming premieres and is available in every country at the exact same moment. So when House of Cards Season 4 premieres next year, at that exact same moment, you could be watching it in as many as 200 countries by then.
Right. I asked Bo Willimon this same question either last year at the festival or 2 years ago, maybe last year. about this idea of binge watching and whether he cares that everybody can watch anything whenever they want, not only wherever they want, but all at once.
Yeah.
Tell me about that meeting, because that sort of has been paradigmatic.
You know, the fun one was actually with Stevie Van Zandt. When we first put up the idea that we were going to put up all of them at once, Stevie's like, whoa, I've been working on this show for 6 months. You're just going to put it out there?
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, just like when you record an album. You just...
Wow.
And he goes, oh, I got it.
Huh.
And the great thing about for House of Cards, though, when you're a creator and you know that you're going to have 13 hours, no matter what, then you can write that show so much more richly.
Well, that's exactly what
he
said. He said he writes it like a movie.
Right. Yeah. So all of our original series play like movies. I think it's why they're difficult for critics to understand sometimes.
Yeah.
When you read the reviews, there's been this huge disparity between how consumers rate original shows from Netflix and how critics do. And I think it's because everyone's still wrestling to figure out what it is. Like Bloodline, people love this show. They need to understand the first season is the pilot. So it's very different than traditional television in that way.
And how we get it, right?
And how you get it, absolutely.
Ted Sarandos, Chief Content Officer at Netflix. Ted, thank you so much
for
your time. I really appreciate it. See you. You got a woo just when you sat down. I don't know who that was. We're going to get real literal with the theme of the day today, mobility in arguably its most extreme form. Those of you native to Aspen or familiar with the world of big mountain sports, skiing to be a little bit more precise, extreme skiing, we'll know our next guest. Chris Davenport is a two-time extreme skiing world champion. He is a native Aspenite, right? Is that what you guys call yourself?
Not quite a native.
All right. Well, he lives here.
Long time.
Two-time world champion skier, mountaineer, entrepreneur to boot. First time in the belly up or no?
Definitely not.
Definitely not. All right. So you know where the bar is then. The bar is in the back.
I do.
Good. So just to give people some context here on what you do in the extreme sense of the word, you have hiked up Mount Everest and skied down.
Yes, yeah, but not from the summit. I was there working, guiding, taking a client to the top. And in the sense of safety, the skiing was kind of secondary. So we skied a little bit lower down on the mountain, but it was still spectacular.
Okay. Good. Why?
Because it's there.
Because it's
as
there.
A very famous mountaineer once said, you know,
it's
the highest mountain in the world. Why not?
The thing we wanted to talk about with you, you are an athlete. You have built your reputation and your brand as an athlete. Sadly, young though you are not a spring chicken, and there will come a day when you will not be able to be an athlete anymore. And you are changing your brand, right? You're becoming an entrepreneur and a speaker, and it's the mobility of the Chris Davenport brand.
Yeah, I think that the sense of evolution that I feel within the industry, within myself as an athlete, as a brand, is really strong. I recognized that early on, that to succeed, to have longevity, the key to longevity was going to be to be flexible, was going to be to understand what it meant to be a brand, was going to be able to understand mobility, basically, so that I could kind of move through my career seamlessly, going from one passion to the next, all within the sort of scope of the mountains and scope of skiing and mountaineering, but with lots of different challenges out there.
Did you sit down one day with, you know, friends and your wife who's here somewhere and say, I need to change my brand?
Not in a single conversation, but I was always very aware of the fact that there are these points in our lives where we need to pivot. There are these points in our lives where we need to reflect. There are these times where we need to say, hey, how do we keep going and still live up to our human potential? We've been talking a lot about that the last couple of days here in Aspen as the Ideas Fest is going on, because myself and another professional athlete, Gretchen Blyler, are speaking tomorrow. And human potential, it doesn't mean you get to the top of Mount Everest, people say, oh, that's the highest peak, what could be next? That's just one element. You win a gold medal in the Olympics. That just shows you what you're capable of, and then you take that to the next logical step. Maybe it's in business. Maybe it's in your personal life. Maybe it's as an athlete. So there's just so many things that you can go through in your life when you realize that you're capable of great things.
There is not physical risk, right, but entrepreneurial risk in being brand mobile, right? You are known as a guy who plans and is very careful and is, you know, breaks down the Everest climb into 16 different steps. How did you do that?
Yeah, there's definitely risks involved. You mentioned the physical ones. You fall down a mountain, it can be bad, right? And there's reputational risks as well. I mean, as a brand, I like to think of myself as highly reputable. People want to hire me to take them to mountains all over the world. Brands, other companies want to sponsor me or get involved because of the respect or that I bring to the table.
Sure.
But it's really important that I guess, continue to kind of keep that very, very high level of raising the bar for myself, I guess you would say, when it comes to the reputation. And, you know, if I screw up, I mean, one little accident can be the end of the business.
So here you go. Mobility and failure. Discuss.
Well, you can't be afraid to fail, and I think that's really, really important. You know, I'm out there putting one foot in front of the other, trying to climb a mountain, telling myself I might not make it to the top, but I'm enjoying the journey. I'm enjoying the entire adventure along the way.
Yep.
You know, I might not succeed with a particular business that I'm involved in the ski industry, but trying to figure out how to make it succeed is really fun. So I'm not always looking for that sort of that gold medal, that top of the mountain. I'm looking more at the experience along the way and what I can learn, what I can get out of it, how it can make me better the next time I'm out there.
Right. Something you said, and I'm gonna change your meaning. You said climbing the mountain, I'm not sure I'm gonna make it to the top because you know weather or whatever. But
sure.
But there's also the I might slip on the ice and fall. So there's a mobility and doubt thing too.
Yes,
confidence, right?
Confidence is huge. Doubt, I never really doubt myself. If I come up with a plan, I'm pretty confident that I can achieve it.
Yeah.
And I go through. We have so much information at our fingertips nowadays, whether it's on the internet or you know communicating with friends. I mean, just understanding the risks that are out there in the mountains.
Right.
So when I go out there, I've got a great plan. This isn't just a wish. I hope I'm going to make it to the top. This is a plan with a lot of logistics behind it, right? And so I go out there pretty confident that I'm going to be able to pull it off. But things happen. There's black swans. There's you know storms. There's things that you can't expect. And so you always have to be willing and able to turn around and find another way.
And pick yourself up.
And pick yourself up, yeah, because there's always another day. And, you know, frankly, in my business, there has to be another day. I can't afford to risk it all.
Chris Davenport, ladies and gentlemen. Chris, thank you so much. That rocked. That was awesome. Thanks, man. Final note on the way out today, circling back to the top of the program, the lack of mobility that Greeks and their money are dealing with right now. Bloomberg News is reporting that Europeans have been buying gold, traditionally the safest of safe havens, at quite a clip this month. The Royal Mint over in the UK says sales of gold coins this past weekend were double the usual rate. Private coin retailer Coininvest.com says it's sold out, and that's French, German, and Greeks buying as well. So go figure. The rest of the world, meh, stock market aside, gold closed up about 0.5% today in New York.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen.
So, there we go. The Dow Industrials plunged 350 points today, even without the Wawa trombones, I would add. 1.9%, 17,596. The NASDAQ off 122 points, 2.4%, 49.58. The S&P 500 gave back 23 points, 2%. Ended things at 2,057. Just like Chris Davenport said, we will pick ourselves up and do the markets again tomorrow. Our daily production team back in L.A. includes Bridget Bondner, Austin Cross, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. Special thanks to the team that got us on the air here today at the Aspen Ideas Festival and also the crowd at the Belly Up. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. We will see you back in L.A. tomorrow night. Thanks for coming. Wait for it. One more thing. Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.